Call this meeting of the Elections Committee to order. Welcome, members. I'm Mike Freiberg. I'm chairing this committee. Amazingly, we have a quorum already, so let the record reflect that. I'm impressed with everyone. I've heard from a few members who are going to be late because of the road condition. I did inform them that anyone who has that issue will be excused. So hopefully we'll have that. Welcome here. This is, it seems like things are conspiring against us to have in-person hearings. I know for many of us, this is the first hearing in person that we've had since March of 2020. So it's good to be back. Unfortunately, we have to deal with some road conditions, but, I think we're hardy people. We're Minnesotans. We're used to driving in the snow. So I'm glad we're all here. Should there be a roll call or?
No, we don't need a roll call
for in-person. Okay. I guess we don't need a roll call for in-person hearings. So the first thing I'd like to do is just have everyone introduce themselves once again. So maybe members say, your name, your term, where you're from. I'd like to hear from the staff, too, just to introduce themselves so we know who we'll be working with. Once again, I'm Mike Freiberg, District 43B, which is all our parts of Crystal, Golden Valley, Plymouth, and Robbinsdale. I'm in my sixth term, first term as elections chair. Really excited to be chairing this committee. I think we'll be doing a lot of important work this year, and I look forward to working with all of you. I don't know, maybe Representative O'Driscoll, should we start with you and just come around this way?
You're the chair.
Let's do it.
Point of a parliamentary inquiry before we do that.
Sure.
I don't like having my back to the speakers and stuff, and since we're kind of on here, can we use the other seats or is there a
seat? Just for members' sake, that's just where members, those weren't intended to be seating assignments.
Gotcha.
That was just where people could grab. So if you'd like to maybe do your introduction, then you can resettle wherever you wish.
As long as I don't have to introduce myself again in my new seat.
No.
Perfect.
We do enjoy hearing from you, but that won't be necessary.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Tim O'Driscoll, my seventh term. I've been on the Elections and Government Operations Committee. I've chaired Government Operations and Elections in the past as well. Currently serving on the Commerce Committee with Chair Stevenson as the Republican lead, and have been involved in pensions and a number of other legislative initiatives in my time here. Happy to be able to be with you folks this morning.
Representative Ben Davis from District 6A, and I'm a freshman representative, so very excited to be here, looking forward to learning from all of you, and very passionate about our elections. And I locally in Brainerd, I'm a pastor. Brainerd's not actually in the district. I live just south of Cross Lake, though, in the district, and happy to be here as well.
Glad to have you here. Representative Stevenson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Zach Stevenson. I represent Anoka and Coon Rapids. I'm in my third term in the legislature. Excited to be here.
Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Nathan Coulter. My district is 51B, which is basically the eastern half of the city of Bloomington. I am in my first term. This is my very first committee hearing. And a particular note for this morning, my district includes the corporate headquarters of Toro. So those of you with your red snowblowers that started on the first poll, you're welcome.
Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Representative Luke Frederick from District 18B, the Mankato area. This is my second term, and I'm excited to be here.
Representative Purcell.
Good morning, Christy Purcell. I represent 58A in the Northfield area, and I'm a first termer.
Representative Altendorf.
PM Altendorf. I'm from the Red Wing area, District 20A, and this is my first term as well.
Vice Chair Greenman.
Good morning. I am Emma Greenman, and I represent District 63B, which is in South Minneapolis, and also for importance for this committee, the highest voter turnout district in the state. And I am excited to be vice chair. I am a second. This is my second term, and I come as a voting rights lawyer, having worked on a lot of these issues for a while. I'm very excited for the work we're going to do this year.
Mr. Brown.
I'm Simon Brown. I'm the committee administrator for the committee. It's my fifth session at the legislature, and I'm also on the Commerce Committee.
Ms. Killian.
My name's Leah Killian. I am actually not the CLA for this committee, but Mike Hermanson is stuck in the snow, so I am filling in today.
Thank you for doing so. Ms. Roberts.
Hi, I'm Helen Roberts. I'm the nonpartisan fiscal analyst for the committee.
Yep. Chelsea Axelson, I'm GOP Research, also filling in today for Lori Cousino, who will be your researcher.
John Beeler, DFL Research. Yep.
And we have a couple pages, too. I don't know if there are permanent pages or if you'd like to say hello or... Thank you for helping.
And my name is Stephen Walker. I live about 5 minutes away at Cumberland.
Great. Well, so this being the first hearing, it is the typical practice of finance committees to hear from the agencies over which they have jurisdiction. So maybe I will give, but before I turn to that, maybe I will give our ranking member, Representative Torkelson, an opportunity to get settled, although I suppose I'm putting some pressure on him to hurry, so I'll just kind of keep talking in a slow and meandering fashion while he does that, because I would like to give our lead member the opportunity to introduce himself. So thank you for coming in the snow. I know it was a challenge for many of us to get here, but I appreciate your efforts in doing so. So I was just having the members, say their name, where they're from, what term they're in. If you have any sort of opening comments as the lead member, I'd certainly welcome those as well. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Pleasure to be here. A little bit snowy out there, as we all know, but made it safely, so I'm glad about that. Paul Torkelson, District 15B, New Ulm being the largest city in my district. I represent all of Brown County, all of Redwood County, and a little bit of Blue Earth County after the redistricting process. This is my eighth term in the Minnesota House of Representatives. Getting a little long in the tooth, I'm afraid, but that's not a bad thing necessarily. My first adventure with the Elections Committee, of course, but not my first adventure with elections. So looking forward to the work we have ahead of us. My theme, I think, is going to be the bipartisan nature of our work. There's a strong tradition in the legislature, especially in the Minnesota House, that action taken in this committee is taken on a bipartisan basis, and that has served us well over many decades, and I would hope that we will keep that perspective in mind as we move forward with our work in this very important committee this year. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. So we have with us the director of the Campaign Finance Board, Jeff Sigurdson, here to present an overview of the Campaign Finance Board. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Sigurdson. Just please identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony, and then we will have some time for questions.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Jeff Sigurdson. I'm the executive director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I guess a little background. I joined state service in 1987 with the Secretary of State's office in their election division. I was there until 2000, in which time I became assistant director with the Campaign Finance Board, and then I became executive director in 2016. I'm perhaps going to abuse what I have here. I'm going to give you a brief overview of the board's mission, and then I also want to talk a little bit about some items that I believe will be coming before this committee for the board, both in terms of fiscal requests and also in terms of some legislative recommendations which the board is finalizing. First, I just want to remind you that the board's mission is to promote public confidence in state government decision making. I guess that's obvious, but it's very key here that through the disclosure of the potential sources of conflicts of interest, of influence on public officials through the lobbying community, of the potential for campaign...
Mr. Sigurdson, if you could just move the mic.
Sure, I apologize.
Thank you.
The potential for making sure that we have disclosure of all the campaign finance sources of income for the campaign. Through that disclosure, we're trying to work with the public to make sure that they can trust their public officials. The three major programs are campaign finance, which you're all very aware of and familiar with. We also have the economic interest statements, which, again, you're all familiar with as public officials. You'll be filing your annual statement here at the end of the month. And then the third program, major program for the board, is the lobbying program, which, again, I'm sure you're familiar with, at least through the communications that you receive through lobbyists. The enforcement and disclosure tools that the board have is, remember that we're a quasi-judicial board. There are six members that are voting members of the board. We're limited to civil penalties. We certainly have no criminal jurisdiction. And the board is very aware that of the potential for damaging the reputations of candidates or public officials or lobbyists, that it's very careful in moving forward and making sure that it provides the sort of information that the regulated community needs to comply with Chapter 10A and Chapter 211B, and that when we do have a situation when there may have been a violation of the provisions that the board regulates, that we follow a very standard or a very set pattern of prima facie determination, probable cause determination, and then finally findings or a conciliation agreement. All of those are set up to make sure that the entity or individual who is facing an allegation of a violation has ample opportunity to appear before the board, present information to the board, and make sure that their side of the situation, their side of the story, is fully considered before the board renders a decision. And that's, I know, sometimes maybe not concern, but a frustration in that the board doesn't, frankly, move very fast. But the statute was set up that way so that all entities who are facing an allegation of a violation have all the time they need to prepare their defense, find legal counsel if they wish to do so, and, again, have a very standard set pattern in which we deal with those allegations.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Is this available online for those of us that might have trouble reading the screens as far away as they are?
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. We'll get a copy and have it. It looks like you have your laptop. We'll have it emailed to you hopefully within the next minute or two.
That would be a really good idea. It's nice to kind of know what's going on in committee.
Sure. Sorry, continue, Mr. Sigurdsson.
Just a reminder, the board is an independent agency. Excuse me. The governor's office includes our agency in their overall budget request, but we're not a cabinet agency. We don't report to the governor's office. The board, again, consists of six members, no more than half of which may be from any political party, and at least two members must be former legislators, one for each party. We have only eight full-time staff and one half part-time position. We're in the Centennial Office Building, so for those of you who are just new to the legislature, we're in the tunnel system. If there's any situation where you want to come over to fill out your public subsidy agreement or get some PCR receipts, we're in the tunnel system. It's easy to come over to our office. There will be coming before you two members for confirmation. This is one of the few agencies where members are confirmed by both the House and the Senate. The terms of the members actually ended on January 1st, although they can serve until July 1st as we wait appointments from the governor's office. At this time, the governor has not made appointments for those two positions. One position is the former DFL legislator, and the other is a current DFL member as well. There are going to be two change items that the board is requesting. The current board budget is $1,167,000. That's based on projected salary and benefit costs for the next 2 years. Comparing that base to the projected salary and benefit costs for the next 2 years, it simply isn't sufficient for the agency to maintain its current staff. The only way to operate within that amount is to reduce the staff from 8 to 7, which would be a 12% reduction in staff size. So the change item is for $110,000 increase per fiscal year. A little history on that. The last significant increase to the board's budget was back in 2014 when it was increased to $1 million a year. So for the next basically 10 years, we've only had $167,000 increased, which was basically what was provided to all small agencies by the governor's office as a way of trying to offset inflation. But that increase was 1.8% per year if you average it out. And at this point now, we're to the point where we would be looking at fixed costs, which is salary and rent, at being well over 95% of the budget available to the agency. And that simply isn't sufficient to cover mailing costs, IT costs, all the other office supplies, all the other sort of quote-unquote items that you have some control over, but which in fact can't be done with the base budget of $1.67 million. Even with the increase, I would argue that we'd be operating very lean. 87% would be going to staff and rent, and only 13% would be available for all the other sort of functions that the board needs. The other change item is to have a $50,000 per year increase in the board's budget, which will afford the board to move its IT to the Azure cloud. That's a cloud option that's run through Mint. It's actually the Microsoft option, but it'd be through Mint. It would allow us to, well, frankly, become a lot more professional in our IT department. Right now, if you come into our office in the Centennial Office Building, you'll see our servers. The production servers are just sitting there. It's not a temperature-controlled room. It's not the way that we want to be in terms of providing our IT services to and making sure that we're available to support our website, which is where our disclosure is through, and also to support, again, the regulated community. Because, again, as you may know, all of your treasurers, or almost all of your treasurers at least, are reporting through Campaign Finance Reporter, which sends us a data file, which is then integrated into our databases. So we need to move out of that situation onto an online platform, or excuse me, onto a cloud-based platform that's more scalable, that will allow us to move to the next version of Campaign Finance Reporter. That's going to be an online version. All the data will be stored in the cloud, so it'll be always going to be backed up, always going to be much more secure than it is in our office in terms of the ability to hack the information, for example. So this is something that I think is going to very much modernize the board's approach to its IT services and allow us to develop applications for the regulated community. The campaign finance program, just to give you a little idea of scale, we have roughly 700 candidate committees registered with us at any one time. We have about 320 political party units registered with us at any one time. There are 75 independent expenditure committees and funds, which operate somewhat differently than regular political committees and funds, and there are 350 of those. They all file multiple reports, of course, during the election year, and all those reports are available the day after the filing period on our website as a PDF, and then the day after that, it's available as a download, again, from our website. A key area that we focus on is the training and client support that we provide, especially to volunteer treasurers. We think volunteer treasurers in many ways are the key to the campaign finance program. There are very few professional treasurers in our client base. So we want to work with them. We understand that Chapter 10A is confusing in the best of circumstances, and frankly, many of them have found themselves in a position that they really didn't anticipate when they agreed to be your treasurer. So we try to provide them with online training. We provide training in the evening. We record our training sessions, so it's always available on our website. And again, we're trying to provide the sort of client support, background support for the use of the reporting application and for any questions they may have so that we can try to avoid problems and keep the volunteer treasurer on track for both their sanity and for the disclosure that they will provide to us. We also administer the public subsidy program, and I'm sorry, there's a typo there. It was actually in 2022. We paid out $2,348,000 to 316 constitutional and legislative candidates. This year was the first time since I've been with the board that we had less than 90% of the candidates sign the public subsidy agreement. 89% signed the public subsidy agreement for the 2022 election. That also, of course, if you sign the agreement, besides receiving or potentially receiving a public subsidy payment if you win the primary election, is also the way that you have access to the political contribution refund program. That's administered somewhat jointly with the Department of Revenue. The Department of Revenue does the heavy lifting. They issue the checks, refunds to donors. In 2020, which is the last election cycle that we have numbers for, there was $1,326,000 refunded to candidate donors through the Department of Revenue and $2,190,000 to party donors. That's about 30% of the individuals who donate to candidates are therefore refunded. The amount that you receive from individuals, about 30% of that is refunded through the political contribution refund program. There are some legislative recommendations. The board has authority in Chapter 10A to provide recommendations to the legislature. It's based on its experiences, usually through compliance issues, but sometimes just the administration of Chapter 10A. We see areas that we think can be improved. It's come before the legislature before, but the board still believes that the definition of independent expenditure is currently defined as express advocacy, which means basically the what you've heard of as the magic words, vote for, vote against, defeat, elect. There's either, depending how you count it, either 8 or 12 magic words that have to be within a literature piece or a campaign piece for it to count as an independent expenditure. That standard is not the only standard available. The U.S. Supreme Court has also approved of a functional equivalent standard, which is when words that cannot be reasonably interpreted as any other purpose can also be viewed as campaign or as another form of express advocacy, and will bring those advertisements in as independent expenditures, which then have to be reported to the board. The board's concern here is not to try and limit independent expenditures. I want to be very clear about that. There is no limitation that you can realistically have on independent expenditures. Rather, we think that they should all be reported, whether they say elect, Representative Smith, or it says Representative Smith is a liar, you need to send him a message. In both cases, the board believes that the real impact there is to try to influence the way people vote. So both advertisements, both pieces of communication should be reported as an independent expenditure, and that just brings those entities who are not using words of express advocacy into the system, so we have a clearer picture of the amount of independent expenditures that are being made in Minnesota, and again, can provide information to the public about who's making those independent expenditures. Another recommendation is dealing with cryptocurrency, bitcoins. Right now, there really isn't anything in Chapter 10A that tells us what to do if a candidate receives a contribution that's with cryptocurrency. The board is not recommending that that be prohibited. Some states have decided to go that route. We don't think that that's required. But we do need to have a process here where bitcoins are turned into U.S. currency within a reasonable period of time, 5 days, 5 business days, so that the fluctuation that you see in that market, either going up or going down, doesn't cause problems. I mean, if somebody gives you a $1,000 cryptocurrency contribution and you hold on to it for a month and now it's worth $2,000, does that mean that it's an excess contribution? Chapter 10A doesn't answer that question right now. So we're trying to, through this recommendation, provide a procedure where you have to convert it in the U.S. currency. If there's an increase or a decrease during that 5 business days, we provide a method to deal with that. Couple other maybe smaller recommendations, but again, this is with the idea that the disclosure that we want to focus on, we think needs to be very important to the public. Otherwise, you're just having disclosure which sort of muddies up the water and maybe distracts from the important disclosure. We believe that fair boosts operated by political party units can be viewed as a multi-candidate political party expenditure. What does that mean? A multi-candidate political party expenditure does not count as a contribution to the candidates that it benefits, as long as there's 3 or more candidates. So, for example, the most common one is the official sample ballot for the party. The candidates can be aware that there's going to be official sample ballot, and that's not a contribution. The political party can make it. It doesn't list it as a contribution to you as candidates who are listed on the sample ballot. This would work the same way. If there's a fair booth, and they allow all the candidates within the county or state, if we're talking about the state fair, to have their material there, and there's more than 3 candidates, we're not going to require, going forward, the idea would be we would not be requiring the party unit to try to figure out how much space was provided to each candidate for their literature. If you look at Chapter 10A now, that's what they should be doing. Is anybody doing that? Probably not. So rather than have disclosure, which would be very confusing and difficult, I think, for the volunteer party unit treasurers to come up with, I think we can say it's not a surprise to the public that if they go up to the Scott County Republican booth that there's going to be literature for the Scott County Republican candidates. If you go up to the Hennepin County, is there a Hennepin County Fair anymore? I don't know. If you go up to the Dakota County Fair, to the DFL booth, it's not going to be surprising that there's literature for DFL candidates. So I don't think we're going to be taking any significant disclosure away from the public, and instead we're going to make it easier for party unit treasurers to comply with Chapter 10A. Now, the non-campaign disbursement category, you may recall, is where you can spend money from your campaign committee, and it doesn't count against your spending limit. One of the areas that the board believes that can be expanded is recount costs. Currently, if a candidate is facing a recount, there isn't anything in Chapter 10A that says that you can use funds from your committee to pay for people to help you with conducting the recount or monitoring the recount. Now, there is an advisory opinion that says that you can go ahead and do that, but advisory opinions, by definition, are only safe harbor for the entity or individual who asked for the opinion. So here we're trying to move the advice in an advisory opinion into the statute so it's available to all candidates. And then the last, I guess, significant recommendation is that we do have, starting this year, committees and funds that are registered with the board that make either contributions or independent expenditures in Hennepin County for certain offices. Basically, it's for the countywide offices or for the city of Minneapolis, Bloomington, major cities, for their city council and other elected officials. If they want to make contributions or independent expenditures, they have to file additional reports during a non-election year so that we, again, have disclosure of the contributions that are coming from these committees and funds and party units to Hennepin County candidates and ballot questions. Right now, there's a gap in the reporting schedule. It's basically set up for a report prior to the primary election. Well, if you have ranked choice voting, you don't have a primary election. So that has created a gap where we would not have disclosure for the contributions that are being made for those cities. And so we've just adjusting that schedule to make it clear that if you have ranked choice voting, you're still covered by the requirement to file a pre-primary report. There are some other technical issues here, which the board believes should be addressed, but they are very technical, so I'm not going to take the committee's time at this point. A quick review of the economic interest statement program. Again, this is where you disclose potential conflicts of interest so that the public knows that if the public official is making a decision that there isn't any possible conflict of interest, or if there is a possible conflict, that they're at least aware of that and can monitor if the public official recuses himself or herself. This is the disclosure of sources of income, investments, property holdings, nature of the business owned. This is something that is much larger than just the legislature. There are about 3,000 public officials who file economic interest statements with the board. And again, candidates at the filing period also file. But the definition of conflict of interest occurs if the public official receives a greater benefit than others in the same general business or occupation. The example I guess I always give is that a member of the legislature who was a farmer could certainly vote on the agriculture bill. On the other hand, if the member of the legislature had an apple orchard, a commercial apple orchard, and there was specific legislation that only affected owners of apple orchards, then they should recuse themselves and not vote on that legislation. The legislative recommendations here are a bit of a contradiction in that we're trying to reduce disclosure for one set of public officials but increase disclosure for other public officials. We are recommending a two-tiered system. The public officials includes all the soil and water district supervisors and watershed management organization members. They have very limited authority. Basically, at least for the soil and water district supervisors, frankly, we're talking about drainage ditches. And so with that in mind, we believe, and there's always a lot of pushback from members of soil and water district supervisors, that they're providing disclosure on information that, or on their investments that would never come into play on the type of decisions that they can make as a public official. This would reduce that so that for those type of members, they would only provide information on their occupation, on any real property that they own, so non-homesteaded real estate primarily, and so that there could be information that potentially would create a conflict of interest as they carry out their duties as a soil and water district supervisor. But we would not be looking for information on investments in IBM or whatever they may have made for their in other areas. So that would be reducing disclosure. We think that it's not necessary. The other two areas, though, we think there are a couple of gaps that could be closed in terms of providing additional information that the public may find necessary. Currently, if a public official serves on an agency that issues licenses and that public official either has a contract or receives a professional license or permit as an individual, or they own a business, at least 25% of a business that receives, again, professional licenses or permits from that agency, they don't have to disclose that. So they could be voting on or against a license that either they receive or perhaps somebody who is also wanting one of those licenses would receive. That seems to be an area that would be appropriate to have disclosure. The other is, and this has been before the legislature before, is the idea that currently all of the disclosure of financial holdings is based on those either owned by the public official or owned jointly by the public official and his or her spouse. There is no disclosure required if the holding is owned entirely by the spouse. And that seems like a gap. In many of the provisions dealing with economic interest statements sometimes are based on what other states have found, and other states have found that you sometimes receive significant additional disclosure if you require disclosure of the holdings which are entirely in the spouse's name. And that's what the board is looking for in that area. The last one is the lobbying program. The lobbying program is, sometimes it seems like a program that's trying to limit what lobbyists can do, and I would argue it's not. It's, again, just trying to provide disclosure. There's in Minnesota, we're somewhat unusual in that there are no fees required to be paid if you want to be a lobbyist. You don't register every year. Your registration lasts. You simply report twice a year on some administrative costs, which I'll talk about in a moment. But there's always the understanding, at least from the board's perspective, that this is the right to petition government. And there's certainly no belief here that lobbyists is a community that we want to reduce or somehow restrain, but we are looking for meaningful disclosure from that program. There are about 1,450 lobbyists registered for, and they represent about 1,500 principals, which are associations which hire lobbyists in Minnesota. Registration is required when an individual is compensated over $3,000 a year from all sources. So it could be $1,500 from this association, $4,000 from that association. You know, it's in cumulative, all of the lobbying compensation you receive. There is, and this sometimes is something that members of the legislature is not aware of. Of course, the primary focus of a lobbying program is the lobbying that you receive here as part of the legislative process. But there is other types of lobbying that should be reported to the board. Administrative rules. If a state agency is adopting administrative rules and an entity is trying to influence those administrative rules, that, again, is administrative lobbying that needs to be reported. Action by the Public Utility Commission. If there's a request for a line or a plant or a rate increase, all of that is lobbying under the definition, and that has to be reported. And then the last is lobbying of metropolitan area government units. That's the 7-county metro area, 16 cities which are sufficient in size to fall under that definition, and then entities like the Met Council and MAC. So, if you're trying to influence their budget or official decisions that those entities are making, that's lobbying. The problem... one other screen to hit here quickly. The lobbying program also has the gift prohibition. The lobbyists report twice a year, once a year from the principal. And in 2021, principals reported $73,800,000 for lobbying expenditures in Minnesota. The lobbyist reports are based on, again, reporting administrative costs. Lobbyists are required to report how much they spent on their phone bill, how much on their office space for clients, if they had administrative support in terms of staff. Those sorts of costs are reported to the board. The board has concluded that, frankly, that isn't particularly useful to the public. And instead, we believe that it would be better to have a program that focuses on the issues that the lobbyist is trying to influence. So, for example, I mentioned that there is... lobbying for metropolitan government units. Well, currently on the form, you check a box saying I'm going to lobby metropolitan government units, and you list how much of your phone bill was for lobbying governmental units. You never say what governmental units. So if you were lobbying Minneapolis for rent control, or you were lobbying, St. Paul for the Ford plant, none of that is ever going to be disclosed. This would change that. The board's recommendation is to move to a model where the lobbyist will say that for my client, I was lobbying Minneapolis, or I was lobbying Hennepin County, and I was lobbying on rent control or disposable plastic bags or whatever the issue may be. They don't have to provide, the public officials that they were contacting, but they at least have to provide disclosure on the issue that was important to their client and the Metropolitan Area unit that it was trying to influence. The Public Utilities Commission is somewhat the same way. Currently, you check a box and you provide how much you spent on your phone bill, but you never have to say which issues were important to you. Here, under this recommendation, they would have to list which particular permit that was before the PUC or other issue before the PUC they were lobbying on in behalf of their client. Administrative lobbying, sort of carrying through with the same idea, rather than just a checkbox and how much you spent on your administrative costs, you now have to say, okay, Department of Health, administrative rule, revisor number, whatever, 2000, and that at least will provide the public with some idea of the issues that you thought, your client thought was important in those administrative rules. And then with the legislative lobbying, it's drilling down on specific issues of interest, which are not currently provided at all under the current model.
Mr. Sigurdsson, if you could move it along here.
Almost done. I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you.
And then the principal would also provide additional information. And
no.
That's it.
Read my mind. Well, thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson. That's very informative. Members, do you have any questions? Yeah, Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I am just curious. You mentioned Bitcoin earlier. I wasn't aware, but do we currently allow campaigns to receive Bitcoin?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bonner. Yes, we do. The closest that staff can see that matches up under Chapter 10A is that you are allowed to receive in-kind contributions. And an in-kind contribution is defined as anything of value other than U.S. currency. And so Bitcoins sort of fall into that. So it is reportable, but there isn't any guidance as to what happens if the value changes, and there isn't any guidance as to how quickly you need to put that into your campaign committee as U.S. currency. So you can receive it. It's an in-kind contribution, and this will provide clarity as to that process.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sigurdsson, I guess that was part of my concern, is that Bitcoin typically has a fluctuating valuation, and we know from recent market events that it can swing wildly, even within a 24-hour period, much less 5 days, and it in some respects has more of a is considered more almost like a stock would be, right? Because it can be used as an investment. Is there any concern about being able to accept Bitcoin for that reason? Is there any consideration about whether there should be limitations even further on that? Because it really, depending on what you're doing with it, even within 5 days, values could fluctuate considerably.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonner. The 5 days, I think the board believes addresses most of your concerns. I mean, I understand that it could be a one-day swing in valuation as well, but currently there's no time constraints. And here the 5 days is basically allowing treasurers who may not be very familiar with the Bitcoin process some time to figure out how to convert that to U.S. currency and move that into the account. But I would say with all of these recommendations, the board is very aware that it's a recommendation. Hopefully I'll be able to find some authors, maybe somewhere in this room, and we can certainly work on refining recommendations if there's a problem seen.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, Mr. Sigurdsson, is about the board's proposal with regard to non-campaign expenditures for recounts, which to me makes some sense. And I wondered if you had any information or discussion about other proposals. I'm sure the board routinely gets inquiries about what could constitute a non-campaign disclosure. And are there other frequent items that you hear from candidates, inquiries about whether something is or should be a non-campaign disclosure?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stevenson. Currently, there are 26 or 27 non-campaign disbursements. It has grown over the years. And at this point, frankly, I think most areas are covered. The questions we receive are, is not so much whether something is a non-campaign disbursement, but just exactly what's included in the category. For example, right now, as a non-campaign disbursement, you can have, a committee can have a, either, you can either call it an end-of-the-year party, or usually it's an election night party. And so now the question is, well, okay, what can we pay for, you know, at that party? So there are sometimes sort of follow-up questions, but the overall categories, I think, are fairly inclusive of any area. The most recent addition, which was last year, was adding the security provision for candidates to provide security at their home and for family members, both for you know, security installation on the house and then also for security for online. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the term, but basically identity theft. You can spend committee funds for that as well. So whenever we receive something like that, either members bring it forth, which was the case in that, or in this case, the board believes it should move its advisory opinions into the general statute so it's available for everyone, which is a long way of saying I don't have any other issues, so I'm sorry.
Representative, okay. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Sigurdsson, for being here today. My question relates to the disclosure requirements for SWCD supervisors. I think that's a good change. It's been a long time coming. I've known of gentlemen and women who have refused to run or refused to serve once they found out that those disclosures were so extensive. So I applaud that change. I think it's a good one. My question is, are there other elected officials where we should or could or do consider a different level of disclosure requirements?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that's a good question. I would say that this is the area that became most evident to the board. As you've stated, we know that there were a number of individuals who, once they received the economic interest statement from us because they were elected to the Soil and Water District or to a water board, they promptly resigned. You know, and so we are aware of that. And it does seem that if the disclosure isn't accomplishing anything in terms of outlining potential conflicts of interest and it's making individuals decide that they no longer want to provide public service, and frankly, Soil and Water District supervisors are not paid that much. That's something that they're doing to try to help their, you know, their community. Then we have a problem that we need to look at. I'm not aware of any other type of category of public officials that are at least as outlined or as highlighted as those are. It's certainly a discussion to have, but I'm not aware of any others.
Representative Torkelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I think it's a good change. I think it should have probably happened some time ago, and I hope that we manage to get it accomplished.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Representative Coulter.
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And forgive me if I'm asking about something that is sort of previously plowed ground here, but it struck me that the distinction or lobbying disclosure that applies to local governments in the metropolitan area, but does not in greater Minnesota. And I'm curious if there's been any discussion on applying that to the entire state. I mean, if I, for example, have some business before Brown County, population 26,000, I don't have to disclose, if I'm a lobbyist, I don't have to disclose that. But if I have business before the city of Crystal, population 22,000, I do. And that seems to me to be kind of a distinction without a difference, so to speak. So I'm curious if there's been any discussion on that.
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter. There has, and I would maybe have even more dramatic illustration. The city of Rochester is not within the metropolitan area. And, of course, there has been a lot of state investment in some of the programs or development programs in the city of Rochester. the City of Duluth, City of St. Cloud, Moorhead. There are a number of larger communities which are outside the definition of lobbying. The board, frankly, decided not to go there this time because you can only climb one mountain at a time. But I don't have a good explanation as to why, back when the lobbying provisions were put in place, there was an exclusion for, I think I frankly can kind of understand why very small communities were excluded. Why larger communities outside the seven county metro area were excluded, I don't have a good answer for. And the board has looked at that issue.
Thank you. Last question from Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretson, I'm wondering, you brought up the issue of express advocacy as it relates to independent expenditures, and I know that there's been a huge growth in that. I'm wondering the last time, if you know the last time in Minnesota where we've looked at that, where we have changed, I guess, those rules and how it stacks up with the federal standard around express advocacy.
Mr. Secretson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, I'm not sure if I quite got the first part of your question, but the second part, let me address, and then we can circle back. There are a number of states that have adopted, in some version or another, the idea of functional equivalence. In the model language that the board is finalizing today is coming from the state of South Dakota, because South Dakota looked at the various provisions that have been developed in other states and came up with what it believes to be a pretty clean definition. And frankly, in staff's view, we agree. South Dakota does have a very straightforward, relatively simple definition to work with. Many other states have adopted it. The Federal Election Commission has had it in place for over a decade. Frankly, they have been challenged in court at least three or four times. They've always won. This is a standard that, again, that was set up in Wisconsin Right to Life 1 and Wisconsin Right to Life 2, which are two U.S. Supreme Court decisions, which acknowledge that express advocacy is not the only way, clearly, to try to influence people's vote, and that you can have this a functional equivalent standard where you're looking at the overall piece and what clearly what the piece was for. So I'm afraid I don't know the last time the board brought this forward. I think initially it brought it forward in 2013, but I'd have to look back to make sure that's a true statement.
Representative Green.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. I guess, for lack of a better way to say it, I'm wondering the last time we changed the law to keep up with what we see right now sort of in the political spending space. Do you have a sense of when the law last changed on the issues of independent expenditure disclosure?
Mr. Secretson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenman, well, in terms of trying to deal with advertisements that are not using express advocacy, the legislature has never passed anything in that area, I guess is my answer.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretson. I'm sure we will have you back before the session is over, so appreciate your presentation. Next, we will be hearing from the Secretary of State's office. If you could, if the speakers could please come forward. I should mention, Representative Torkelson, too, we did not receive Mr. Sigurdsson's presentation slides in advance, but Mr. Sigurdsson, please send them to Mr. Brown. We'll make sure to send them out afterwards. We have already sent out the slides for the subsequent presentation, and we will endeavor to receive the slides in advance subsequently so you can read them.
I have some printed copies.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you. If you could please make sure Representative Torkelson gets one and then first and then hand them out. Thank you. That's helpful. We were going to hear from Secretary Simon himself. However, he had a last-minute family funeral to attend, so he's not able to be here. But he will be here, I'm sure, on more than one occasion henceforth. But we do have members of his office here who are able to present. Let's see, they are getting set up with the slides at the moment, so I'll just hold tight for a moment here. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Maeda. I'm the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State's office. Joining me today at the table is our Deputy Elections Director, Paul Inell. And we're here to give a broad overview of the election administration process in Minnesota. Hopefully I can get this to work. I thought I'd start my, well, to back up my own personal background in election administration, I actually started working for the Secretary of State in 1990 in the business services portion of the office. Is when Secretary Simon presents, our office does much more than elections. In 1990, I got to know Mr. Sigurdsson because we were colleagues in the office, and I have a lot of respect for his work in this field as well. I administered my first elections in 1996 as the Washington County election supervisor. The state primary and presidential election in 96 were my first elections that I was in charge of administering for the county. And then I actually spent four sessions working in the House Public Information Office, and that happened to coincide with the Ventura administration. So it was a very interesting time to watch your work, and I came to respect the work that you do in this body. And then I rejoined Elections Administration, becoming the Hennepin County Election Supervisor. And then I spent the bulk of my career as a Minnetonka City Clerk, where elections is one of the duties of a city clerk. I was appointed to my current position in 2019. It's been great. My background has been great because our election administration process in Minnesota is really a partnership between our office, our 87 county partners, and our thousands of city, township, and school district administrations. Elections in Minnesota are run really at the local level, so it's been really helpful in me and my position to understand the roles of the different levels of government. Before I begin my remarks, I'll note that when we certified the 2022 election with the State Canvassing Board in late November, it was our first bad snowstorm of the year. And then when we reconvened the State Canvassing Board a few weeks later to certify recount results, it was our second bad snowstorm of the year. And then this morning, I think someone's trying to send me a message. I need to do my job behind the scenes and not do public presentations. But I thought I'd start really the presentation with a recap of 2022. Every election that I've ever administered has its own challenges, and 2022 is no exception. Of course, you know, 2022 is a redistricting year, and for election administrators across the state, that means working within the statewide voter registration system to update the address information first to reflect the different boundaries that happen after redistricting, but then ultimately updating all 3.5 million voter records to make sure that all the voter records are, the voters' records reflect the proper districts that the voter resides in. So it's a lot of work on our county partners and our own staff to make sure all that work gets done before the election was run in, well, the state primary in August. And to make it even more challenging, we had the unfortunate death of Representative Hagedorn last winter. So we had a vacancy in Congressional District 1, meaning we had to have a special primary and a special election in the fall, well, spring and fall of 2022. And what that meant, it was really challenging because the special election actually fell on the state primary day, meaning in Congressional District 1, we were operating under two sets of boundaries. The person elected to fill the vacancy was running in the old Congressional District 1 boundaries. The candidates running in the state primary in Congressional District 1 were running in the new Congressional District 1 boundaries. This was really challenging to get work our way through. Our counties did a tremendous job. I know there was some voter confusion on seeing the same candidates on different sides of the same ballot, but we worked our way through in making sure we did our best efforts in educating the voters on why that was. So it was challenging to have that occur in 2022 with redistricting already being a challenging part of the job because many of our county partners had turned over since the last redistricting, so many of our county partners are doing the work for the first time, as well as members of our team, but we worked our way through redistricting with minor issues popping up here and there. A lot of my work in 2022 was really trying to get out accurate information to kind of fight back against the misinformation and disinformation we're hearing not only from the national level, but within our own state. Within our own state, we had groups of people really attending county board meetings with the ask of not using voting equipment, that we go to all hand counts in Minnesota. And unfortunately, fortunately, no county actually did that. We'll talk a little bit in this presentation on why you can trust our voting equipment. But so a lot of my work in 2022 is going to county board meetings, doing public presentations on getting out accurate information on why you can trust our elections as being fair and secure. And we'll kind of get into the details of that in our presentation. We did have two House recounts in 2022 after the November election. It happened to fall within House Districts 3A and 3B, and the recounts were conducted by the five counties in 3A and the two counties in 3B, and they confirmed that the results from the November election were accurate. And that's one of the ways we know that our voting equipment is accurate, is we do have recounts after nearly every statewide election that our process is to actually hand count and review each ballot that was cast in that election to confirm that our machines actually counted the ballots correctly on election night. We also have, and Paul will get into the details of this, we have a post-election review after every statewide general election where random precincts are selected in all 87 counties and certain races are hand counted to confirm that the voting equipment did work as it should on election night. The second part of that law actually involves our office, where we do a deeper dive on certain precincts that are randomly selected in that process, where we look at all the materials that were used in the 2022 election, getting down to how they hired election judges, how the counties and cities train their election judges. We do a deep dive into looking at everything that was used in the 2022 election. We're now in the process of scheduling those. We hope to get those done by the end of February. I will note in the 2021 post-election review, Brown County was mentioned earlier today, but I was the one that did the Brown County post-election review, and it really was one of the ways I got through the difficulties of the 2020 election, because I was – the night before, I was finalizing my review of the Brown County before I actually met with the county auditor, and the last thing I had to review was the training she did for her city and township clerks, which was a simple YouTube video with her standing with an overhead projector projecting behind her slides, and it really rekindled my love of elections, because Jean was a retiring county auditor, and just the fact that she was so passionate about the way she did her job is reflective of all our 87 counties. We have a lot of great election administrators across the state, not only at the county level, but at the city and township and even the school district level. People that get into the work of administering elections tend to really stay in the work because they're passionate about doing a fair and accurate job of running elections in our state. That said, the last bullet on this slide, we have seen a fairly substantial turnover at the county level of elections administrators leaving the job, which concerns me. And so one of the things our office is really focused on in 2023 is doing a better job, or not better job, but revamping our training materials to include onboarding new election staff. We had some election officials that quit in the summer of 2022, which was really challenging because most of our counties do not have a deep bench of people that can then do the election administration work. And so we're really trying to develop more training materials in the scenarios where we're seeing a higher and higher turnover of election officials across the state.
Yeah. Mr. Maeda, you might want to move, just looking at the number of slides you have here, you might want to move a little faster. I'm hoping to leave about 10 minutes for questions.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, I'll move very quickly through the rest of my slides. So a lot of this presentation is delineating the different roles between our office, the counties, cities, townships, et cetera. Our office, Secretary Simon is the chief election official of the state. Our office is responsible for training the counties. We do a statewide training every even election year. And then we administer the statewide voter registration system, SVRS, which The counties are the ones that actually update the voter records, but our office administers the system statewide. And SVRS, in case you didn't know, actually interfaces with different state databases to verify the voter records, including the DVS database, the driver's license information, Social Security information. We get death records from the Department of Health, and then our state is one of 33 that belong to a consortium called ERIC, the Electronic Registration Information Center, where we share our voter data with other states, and then to make sure that our voter data remains up to date as well. When you file with our office, your affidavit of candidacy gets posted on our website. So we maintain a database of candidates. And then, we, of course, on election night, we have an election reporting system. We certify voting equipment. So before any piece of equipment can be used in Minnesota, there's a federal certification process that has to go through. And then we certify that it meets our state law requirements. We are responsible for publishing election administration guides. So we have a county auditor guide, a city and township clerk guide, school district clerk guide, and then a election judge guide that we keep and make available to members of the public and voters as well. We do some voter education and outreach. Paul will get into the post-election audits. We have rulemaking authority. And the last bullet on the slide is really important because I think it's a misconception of our office, is we are not an enforcement agency. So when someone is alleging a violation of election law, that is investigated at the local level, the county attorneys and law enforcement's at the local level. The county duties are very substantial in election administration in the state. They are the ones that update the voter registration records. They are the ones responsible for the ballots, not only proofing and laying them out, but making sure they get printed in the quantities sufficient for an election. The voting equipment, for the most part in our state, the counties are the ones that buy the voting equipment. So they are the ones that purchase, program, and test the equipment. They are the ones responsible, and some cities do this as well, is administering absentee voting in the state. They train their city and township and election judges for election day. They are the ones that actually compile election results from their precincts on election night and then report them to us. And then they are the ones that do the post-election work of certifying the election and then doing the post-election review. Cities are the ones that determine their precinct boundaries and polling locations. They hire the election judges and assign them to their precincts. And they are the ones that administer health care facility absentee voting. If you're not aware, nursing home residents in the state get teams of election judges go out to their nursing homes to help the residents vote. And then some counties also administer absentee ballots. In 2019, we stood up a cyber navigator program to fight back against or protect our systems against cybersecurity attacks. We were fortunate to find a very qualified former naval officer to stand up that program. He's done a lot of great work in making connections between the county election staff and their IT staff, because fighting cybersecurity requires teamwork at the county and city levels. So Bill has done a fabulous job doing that. We partner with our federal intelligence agencies. We get regular updates from Homeland Security and the FBI, and which includes some classified briefings that Secretary Simon, myself, and several other members of our staff attend. Our voting equipment in the state, we basically have three different voting system vendors. The vast majority of our state use a company called Election Systems and Software out of Nebraska. We have a handful of counties that use Dominion Voting Systems. And then we have three counties that use a vendor called Hart InterCivic. The other thing to note is in 2002, there was a federal law passed known as the Help America Vote Act, which required that every polling place in America have a device that allows a voter to vote privately and independently. So we have those devices in our state as well. Again, our voting systems are incredibly accurate and secure. We do federal certification, our state certification I mentioned, but before every election, the cities and counties test every piece of voting equipment that's used in election to make sure that it is accurately counting the ballots correctly. And there's actually a public accuracy test that's required in every jurisdiction within 14 days of the election, where two election judges of different major parties feed a pre-marked deck of ballots into the equipment, and they compare it with the way they pre-mark it with the results tape that's run as part of that. And this is open to all members of the public. Secretary Simon really made an effort in 2022 to make sure that people are aware of this public accuracy test going on in all these jurisdictions, so people can see before the elections that the voting equipment is working correctly. The public accuracy test has to result in 100% accurate result, and so before the equipment can be used in every election. So we will continue educating the public to take advantage of processes in our system pre-election if they have questions about any of our voting processes. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Leno.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. As David mentioned, my name is Paul Linnell, and I'm the Deputy Elections Director. I come to the office, been here for about 4 months now, having previously served as the Elections Manager for Anoka County prior to this. So as David mentioned, with the statewide voter registration system, our office houses and maintains that system, but the data entry is done at the counties. When anyone registers in Minnesota, they need to prove that they are who they say they are and they live where they say they live. So this is done through the registered voter information being checked against those multiple databases that David mentioned. So first, the ID number on the registration is verified against the Minnesota driver's license and the Social Security Administration databases. If that information can't be verified, then that voter record is flagged for further review. Driver and Vehicle Services also maintains a list of the non-citizens here on temporary visas, so records for any non-citizens who may have registered to vote are flagged, challenged, requiring that they answer questions under oath before being allowed to vote if they are not a citizen, and cases are referred to a county attorney for further review if necessary. Regular reports are received from the Department of Health and Social Security Administration to identify when a voter has passed away. So those voters are marked as deceased and will not appear then on the polling place rosters when those are generated ahead of the election. Records of voters that are convicted of felonies are challenged based upon notice from the court system or the Department of Corrections. And those challenged voters, again, are required to answer questions under oath before being allowed to vote. If an individual that is challenged attempts to register or votes while ineligible, that case is then referred over to the county attorney's office. Once a voter is registered, a postcard is mailed to their residence. So I'm sure all of you, after getting registered, received that postal verification card, including the voter's name, address, precinct, and polling place information. If that card is returned, that voter's record is challenged, and they must answer those questions under oath before they're allowed to vote. If a second card is returned as undeliverable, then that voter record is inactivated. Records of voters that have moved are updated based on national change of address data provided by the Postal Service and DVS. And that information, as David mentioned, is also shared through ERIC, so cross-state information sharing to make sure that those records remain up to date. The statewide voter registration system is also used to generate those election day rosters. A majority of counties in the state do use electronic poll books. Those electronic rosters contain a static file that is downloaded from SVRS and uploaded onto the equipment. There's no live connection from any electronic rosters to SVRS. Polling place rosters also have, electronic rosters always have a paper backup, so in the event that there's an issue, something arises with the equipment, they have a paper roster to use in that case. After the election, those counties do enter voter history in SVRS for every registered voter that cast a ballot on election day or absentee, and also enter election day registration for new voters and those that may have updated their information on election day. Any potential voting violations that are found through this data entry process, including ineligible voters who cast a ballot or someone casting more than one ballot, are referred over to the county attorney's offices for review. Voters who register on election day are subject to the same verification procedures as voters who register ahead of election day, their eligibility is always verified through SVRS as well. Finally, each January, actually coming up next week, there's an annual process called annual list maintenance, where voters who have not voted or updated their record in 4 years are inactivated, so they must re-register or update their information before they're able to vote in a future election. SVRS is also where all absentee ballot records are entered. So ballots are only issued to those that have completed an absentee ballot application or registered voters that live in a designated mail ballot precinct. In SVRS, the absentee ballot record is linked to a registered voter record at the time of entry. If a voter is not registered or if they've moved or changed their information, they are sent non-registered materials with their ballot that must be completed in order for their ballot to be accepted and counted. All absentee and mail ballots have a unique ballot ID number. So this ensures that a voter can only have a single active ballot at any given time. In the event that a ballot is lost or damaged, it would be spoiled in the system and a replacement ballot would be sent with a new ballot ID number. After a voter returns their absentee ballot or mail ballot, it's reviewed by a ballot board. Absentee ballot boards are established by counties and the cities that are designated to administer absentee voting. Ballot boards are required to include a sufficient number of party-balanced election judges and can also include deputy county auditors and deputy city clerks. These ballot boards review all of the returned absentee ballots to ensure that all required information is completed on those signature envelopes, including verifying identification numbers and verifying that the envelope is signed by the voter and a witness. If a ballot is rejected, a replacement ballot is sent to the voter with a note indicating why it was rejected, and then that voter can vote a replacement ballot that's sent to them or choose to vote at the polling place. Once a voter's ballot is accepted, that information is immediately recorded in SVRS. So this is what ensures that those polling place rosters are updated and reflect that a voter who's voted by absentee has already voted and can't vote at the polling place. Again, no absentee vote totals are generated until after the close of polls on election day. So just the same as the polling place results, those are not counted until after close of polls. At the polling place on election day, there's multiple safeguards that help to ensure the elections are administered fairly. This starts with the requirement of party-balanced election judges, no more than 50% plus one, if an odd number, or 50% of election judges of one party in a polling place. All election judges are trained and certified with additional training requirements for head judges. Judges take an oath at the start of the day, affirming their commitment to perform their duties according to the law, to prevent fraud, deceit, and abuse, act in an impartial manner, and to not create an advantage for their party or candidate. Outside of election judges and voters, there's a limited list of persons who are authorized to be in the polling place on election day, including party-appointed challengers, media with credentials, representatives authorized to observe, assistants, a sergeant-at-arms if those are appointed, and then a peace officer if summoned by the election judges to assist. No campaigning or soliciting is permitted within the polling place on election day, and voters must be allowed to go to and from the polling place without interference. The voting equipment that's used at the polling places is also secured throughout the process. Memory devices are sealed into the ballot counter during pre-election testing that David mentioned, and then those seal numbers are recorded on the precinct certification sheet and verified at the start and end of the day. Before the polls are opened, a tape is printed with all of the offices, candidates, and vote totals, confirming that those are all at zero at the start of the day. And this tape remains sealed in the ballot counter throughout the day and stays connected to the first copy of the results tape that prints at the end of the day. And ballot counters are prohibited from being connected to the internet. Throughout the day, election judges perform balancing audits to confirm that the number of voters that have signed the roster matches the number of ballots cast during the day. And these numbers must balance at the close of polls. After 8 p.m. and the last voter has finished voting, the polling place is open for anyone to come and observe the closing process. And multiple results tapes are printed and the election judges sign on those tapes. After the close of polls, unofficial results are transmitted from the polling places to the counties for entry into the state election reporting system. So this is where results are compiled and posted to our public-facing website. As a first step, those unofficial results are delivered to the counties. So this is typically done either through an encrypted wireless modem transmission or by directly uploading the data from a precinct USB memory device that's delivered back to the county. Once absentee and polling place results are available for a precinct, those results files are uploaded to the state election reporting system and posted to our site with a refresh that takes place about every 10 minutes. So there's no unexplained spikes or dumps of votes, is some terminology that's been used, only regular updates that reflect these precinct results that are uploaded as they're received from the counties. After the results tapes have printed and closing procedures are completed, the judges return the sealed ballots to the county and store ballots and other materials in a secure location with those ballot box seals unbroken. Counties then begin reviewing and proofing election results and statistics. Those summary statements are audited against the unofficial results to verify the accuracy of data in preparation for the canvass. So jumping ahead to the post-election review, so every county across the state randomly selects precincts at their canvassing board meetings where a hand count audit is performed to confirm that the voting equipment had correctly counted the ballots. The number of precincts selected is based on the size of a county with a minimum of two. So each year, each general election year, the contest for either president or governor, U.S. representative, and U.S. senator, if it's on the ballot, are recounted by hand. This year, some counties did choose to count additional offices and more precincts than required by law to further demonstrate and affirm their accuracy of their equipment. And these post-election reviews, these hand count audits, again, reaffirm that the voting equipment was counting the ballots accurately as it has in previous cycles. Go to the next slide. So statute does outline the margins for acceptable performance at these post-election reviews. They were updated in 2021 and made, I think, even tighter than before. So they're some of the tightest standards in the country. If the counts are off by more than these thresholds, then additional precincts do need to be counted. So ballots that are counted by hand in the post-election review do take into account voter intent. So, for example, if a voter did not fill in the oval next to a candidate, but rather circled their name or indicated otherwise that that's who they wanted to vote for, those are counted during the hand count but don't count against the acceptable performance by the voting equipment because it's performing as intended. Any changes in the results totals in the contest that are included in the post-election review are incorporated into the official results that are canvassed by the state canvassing board. As one of the final steps, as David mentioned, following the election, the Secretary of State's office will meet with counties, cities, and townships to review the election performance in precincts that were randomly selected at the state canvassing board meeting. So there's a total of 32 precincts, four in each congressional district that are part of this additional review. This will involve a more detailed audit of the procedures and forms used in the election to identify any common challenges that were encountered and determine areas for improvement and for our office to help update the training and guidance that we plan to roll out ahead of the next election cycle. So with that, I will yield back.
Thank you, Mr. Linnell. Questions from members? Representative Torkelson, I didn't see you raise your hand, but you have a look like you might have.
I'm giving you the look.
Okay, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Maida, I believe, and it refers to the CD1 election that we went through this past cycle, and I realize certainly that the circumstances were a bit of a perfect storm, a number of unusual, you know, things just kind of lined up in an unusual way, but it still was, frankly, confusing for some voters in my congressional district because of the situation you described in your remarks. Is there anything that could be changed to avoid a similar situation from happening in the future?
Mr. Maida.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, that's a great question. I actually, when we were putting together our legislative agenda, tried to come up with a way that we could have, by statute, administered that election a little cleaner. And I'm still thinking of ways. It's obviously the person that was elected to fill the vacancy is representing the old district, so you want the voters in the old district to be able to vote who's representing them. But then the new district has to reflect the voters in the new district, so I don't know how you reconcile that, but we'll continue to try to work with that.
Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that answer, Mr. Maida. I guess one of the things that was especially difficult was the timing of having those two elections on the same day. Why was that required, that we do those both on the same day?
Mr. Maida.
Mr. Chair and Representative Turkelson, all the timeline for the elections is all spelled out in statute. So that is something we could potentially look at to avoid that happening in the future again.
Representative Turkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Maida. I think we should look at that. You know, when we had those stacked up on the same day, that was probably the most difficult thing for the average voter to try and kind of get his or her mind around. And I would hope that we could maybe take a look at that. The odds of this happening again in the future are almost nil, but it did happen, and we should, I hope, react properly. Thank you, Mr. Maida. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional member questions? Oh, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to take the follow-up on Representative Torkelson's question to the testifier. Part of that timeline also is created by, is driven by when the vacancy is created too. And so you obviously can't plan someone's death. And so the, you know, natural circumstances take care of that. When the governor declares the election also is governed by statute as well. So there are some things I agree with Representative Torkelson that probably needs to be investigated about how that process works. Because if there's questions about voter confusion, we don't need to multiply and exponentiate the issues that we have out there right now as a result of that. So just my two cents from past experience with this committee and elections.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Any additional member comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Maeda, and thank you, Mr. Linnell. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you in the future. I think with that, I don't have any additional items on the agenda, so unless there's any member questions, Representative Torkelson, you kind of have the look again.
I'm giving you the look again, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, just, Representative Torkelson.
Curious what the plans are for this committee moving forward. Are we going to go back to our normal meeting time exclusively, or do you anticipate other special meetings, and what might be on the agenda in the near future?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Representative Torkelson. Seeing as no bills have been introduced yet, it's hard to say exactly. I do anticipate, though, once we see what's out there, we will probably be hearing bills. We, you know, the standard practice is for 3 days notice to be provided. To the extent I can expand on that, I'll let you know personally what the plan is for hearings. We will, at this point, we're scheduled just at the normal time, Wednesdays at 8:30. I hope we won't have to have evening meetings or Friday meetings anytime soon. Seeing as this committee is meeting only once a week, I do anticipate that will happen at some point. My hope would be to avoid that until the last possible moment. Certainly, I hope it won't happen anytime soon, but it is a possibility at some point, as it is with any committee, particularly one that meets only once a week.
Well, thank you for that, yeah. Mr. Chair. Do you anticipate having any rules specific to this committee?
Like rules such as, a 24-hour rule for amendments is likely there. Okay, and we anticipate that the rules will be sent out today, too, but it will include a 24-hour rule for amendments, which is pretty typical among committees for new members. Representative Torkelson?
I think that's it for now, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. Any additional questions? Okay. Seeing none, we are adjourned.